We are continuing in a study of the Gospel of John, and we are most of the way through chapter 8. As a matter of fact, Lord willing, finishing chapter 8 today. And as far as the place through which we have come, there's been a lot of dialogue that we've read of an interchange, a public interchange between Jesus and many opponents there on the temple grounds in Jerusalem. And where we come to at John chapter 8, when we reach verse 48 and go on to 59, is a breaking point in the tension. This comes up a number of times, but this is one of those times when, because of what Jesus claimed, they're ready to kill him on the spot. In the last few chapters, from 7 and on, we've noticed this constant talk of the fact that there were those who wanted to kill Jesus. This is one of those points at which you see it come to a head. And we have covered now, since we started the intensive study at chapter 7 here recently, but we've seen quite a lot of this interchange, belief and unbelief, of opposition to Jesus, many challenges, in the context of Jesus having chosen at a certain point in one of these feasts to go public again in spite of the fact that people wanted to kill him and start declaring over and over again his messiahship. We've seen that, this pattern so far. And again, this comes to a breaking point. Just before, let's see, I'm going to read at verse 48, but just as it leads up to this, we know that Jesus has said some pretty confrontational things to those who are listening. He has basically, well, I'll read verse 47, where Jesus said, He who belongs to God hears what God says. The reason you do not hear is that you do not belong to God. That's pretty confrontational, isn't it? To address people directly and speak to them like that. Well, our account goes on to say this. The Jews answered him, "Aren't we right in saying that you're a Samaritan and demon-possessed?" "I am not possessed by a demon," said Jesus, "but I honor my Father, and you dishonor me. I am not seeking glory for myself, but there is one who seeks it, and he is the judge. I tell you the truth, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death." At this, the Jews exclaimed, "Now we know that you're demon-possessed. Abraham died, and so did the prophets. Yet you say that if anyone keeps your word, he will never see death. Are you greater than our father Abraham? He died, and so did the prophets. Who do you think you are?" Jesus replied, "If I glorify myself, my glory means nothing. My Father, whom you claim as your God, is the one who glorifies me. Though you do not know him, I know him. If I said I did not, I would be a liar like you. But I do know him and keep his word. Your father Abraham rejoiced at the thought of seeing my day. He saw it and was glad." "You are not yet 50 years old," the Jews said to him, "and you've seen Abraham?" "I tell you the truth," Jesus answered, "before Abraham was born, I am." At this, they picked up stones to stone him, but Jesus hid himself, slipping away from the temple grounds. Well, I want to draw attention to or try to focus on what is the crux of this interchange again. The crux of this conversation. And I think the issue comes down again to this. Who really knew God? The folks offended here, offended to the point of being ready to pick up stones and throw them at Jesus, to bring about his death, not just to toss a few stones like have been tossed at our windows this week. We had that happen, by the way. But they were ready to kill him. These folks who were offended thought they knew God. They thought they had a place of right, let me put it that way. A place of right among the people of God. We are descendants of Abraham. We belong to the people of God. Why should you question that? Why do you tell us that we don't belong to God? And they thought of Jesus as an enemy, as a problem, a corrupter of the truth, a bad teacher, a corrupter of faith. They regarded him as being arrogant, as having delusions of his own grandeur. They charged him with being sponsored by the devil and not by God. Charged him with demon possession. You know, who sponsors your teaching? I think is the gist of what they were saying. But all the time, and this is one of the dynamics that's so striking to me in this, all the time that they're thinking this, passionate about this, ready to kill him, he was from God. All this time. And the very God, think of it this way, the very God they thought he was blaspheming was commending him to the world for honor, to be looked upon as object of hope. But he was in truth promising a solution to death itself. Jesus said, "I tell you the truth. Whoever listens to my word will never see death." I know that these listeners wondered exactly what he meant at an early portion that we read some time ago. They wondered, what does he mean? He says, "My Father, you know, my Father sent me." And they asked him that. Who's your Father? Where's your Father? They had asked him. Well, at this point, they no longer have to wonder. Because Jesus, in effect, said, "My Father is the God you thought you knew. My Father is the God you thought you knew. You claim him as your God. That's my Father, and he is concerned about my glory." One of the things by way of application that crossed my mind during this whole reflection on this portion would be that we are never neutral in this world in our conclusions about God. Not really neutral in this world about our conclusions about God, because it is impossible to be neutral. I mean, here it's obvious. This is absolute an enemy relationship, and they are ready to kill him. But it crossed my mind that we're never neutral to God. Really. It's impossible to be neutral. And any grappling with the claims of Jesus Christ, even if you took just one chapter, chapter 8, in the Gospel of John, any dealing with his claims leaves no room at all for neutrality. There's got to be some conclusion about claims like these. I think one of the confusing things about living in our culture, in living in this era in our culture, is that neutrality in matters of religion and conviction is lauded not only as being possible, but as being admirable. Neutrality of conclusion about matters of the truth, about faith and who God is, it's lauded not only as possible, but as admirable. And there are very, very many, I think, who would assert rather energetically, even assert passionately, and to their minds as sincerely as they know, that they avoid taking a stand of conclusion about matters of faith and religion as a matter of principle for them, because they believe it to be more mature, more astute, and more open-hearted and open-minded to not say this is the truth about things, is regarded often as being the most mature thing, the most open-minded thing. Does that make sense? Am I speaking what you see in our culture? But the reality of it is that we all, we all live beliefs. Out of our what we conclude, we live. And there is no such thing. I declare this with all confidence. There is no such thing as a real suspension of conclusion about the meaning of life. It can be very confusing and you say, I don't know this or that, but there's no way to really suspend a conclusion on the meaning of life because we live out our lives based upon what we believe, what we conclude about things like God. And particularly if you've heard of Jesus Christ, about the person of Jesus Christ. We all live what we have concluded, what we believe about it. We make our decisions. We pursue our desires. We invest our energies in all things that we care about based on conclusions that we draw. And those can be, you know, informed, and we can change and grow, but it's not like we haven't drawn a conclusion. There's no such thing as a true suspension of conclusion about something like the claims of Jesus Christ. Now, of course, here in this passage, what do we see? We see militant opposition to him. We see him treated as an enemy. And sometimes you see that. I saw it this week. I had the most fascinating experience. And you perhaps can pray with me, because this has got to be from our own neighborhood. I had never met these two young men before. But I came out that door next to my office, walked down to the sidewalk, and two teenage men, young teenage men, were passing. And they looked at me. One of them looked at me. He hissed at me and said, "Satan rules." You know? I thought, what motivates a young man? Just seeing me emerge from a church to hiss at me and say, "Satan rules." So there is such a thing as this militant opposition. If you would think of that young man and pray for him, and then the fellow that was with him, both of them were just mocking, laughing. I don't think I prompted it. I didn't come out and say anything offensive. You know, I just walked out of the door. And that was all it took. Anyway. But not all rejection of Jesus looks that militant. And in our culture, there's a way that it comes, that rejection of Jesus comes across as sincere. Does it make sense what I'm talking about? One could talk like this. One could say, "Look, I'm not upset with Jesus. I just don't want to live in the box of one particular faith. I'm okay with people having their specific religious faiths, and Jesus means a lot to a lot of people. That's good. That's really good. But I see good in a lot of different religions and philosophies, and I don't feel that I ought to have to reject any of them." Is that the kind of thing that is sometimes said? I'm trying to think that through. But perhaps that last phrase is the key one. I feel that I ought not to have to reject any of them. The problem with that is that neutrality with regard to Jesus is rejection of Jesus, according to how he presents himself to the world in this book. It is quite a thorough denial, and I've wondered in personal conversation. I haven't had very many of this exact conversation, but I've wondered if it would be a help to someone. If someone were to speak like our culture speaks to me personally, I would want them somehow to hear what it really means for them to say, "I just don't want to be in that box. I just don't want to limit myself, you know, to Jesus and that box." To say, "Do you realize?" And I honestly don't know how the conversation would go for me, but I would want to say to them, be fairly bold to say to them, "Do you realize that it is a conclusion? It is a definite conclusion. To say, I'm going to suspend a verdict on Jesus is quite the same thing as saying the story of Jesus in the Bible is not true. Jesus did not come from God. Jesus is not the Son of God. And God, whoever he is, does not approve of Jesus like this gospel says. And I have a better understanding of my universe and my world than Jesus did. If Jesus lived and actually said that anyone who believed his words would not see death, then he's either misguided or lying, and I don't need Jesus' help in the face of my coming death. It is the same. I don't mean to be caustic in talking like that. But to say I won't limit myself to Jesus for my hope, for my meaning of life, my purpose in life, I won't limit myself to Jesus, is quite the same as saying this is not true about him. And I just wonder if in conversation, I think quite definitely I would want to go there as well as I am sincere as I knew how. Jesus said, "I tell you the truth. If anyone keeps my word, he will never see death." And there's no one who just sort of doesn't believe that. You know, there's no middle ground in the face of what Jesus says. No middle ground. Let's go to the conclusion of what this came to and how Jesus spoke to them as they interacted with him. I think that the words of verse 58 express the greatness of Jesus' person in one of the most strongest ways of all. Verse 58, what Jesus said, it's brief, it's two words when you reduce it down, but it's one of the strongest ways. I need to give a little bit of background. They had the interchange, and they mentioned the patriarch Abraham and the prophets. So why did they bring that up? Why did they bring up Abraham and the prophets? It was part of their challenge to Jesus' claim that he had a solution for death. That's why they responded that way. Wait a minute. You have a solution for death? Listen to your words and you'll never see death. And they responded concerning Abraham. Abraham was the revered father of their race and of their faith, to whom God had promised the coming of their nation and the land in which they lived. The prophets all agree that the prophets were spokesmen from God. And yet which among them, Abraham or the prophets, had ever claimed that they personally had the solution for death? And if you just listened to them, then you could avoid it. And they all died. So they challenged Jesus in this way. Who do you think you are? See, it must have looked so arrogant to them for Jesus to say that. And if it's not true, it's very arrogant. But Jesus brought the truth in the Word. I often wonder. I think of it this way. I think Jesus could have been such good news to them, their Messiah having come. And yet in this instance, you see that it was not. Jesus diverted their question away from the arrogance topic. Is this a matter of ego? Is this a matter of competition with God the Father? Jesus said, no, and not at all. And as a matter of fact, think of it this way. Both God the Father and Abraham would commend Jesus to you. That's what's going on in this passage. The way Jesus concluded, and this is what I'm really driving to, in verse 58... the way he concluded with them is really quite a startling thing in response to that. Remember, the logical sequence of thought is, you're saying you have a solution to death, but all the foundation of our faith and heritage, those individuals, Abraham, the greats, and the prophets, didn't seem to have that, and they died. But you're saying something different. And Jesus, it comes right down to the specific thing. Jesus said, Abraham looked forward to my day. As a matter of fact, he saw my day and was glad. And they're wondering, you know, it's not just that Abraham was looking forward to something, and thinking about it, it sounds like Jesus is saying that he was somehow there. "You've seen Abraham?" they challenged him. What? Jesus responds, it's dramatic. "Before Abraham was born, I was." No. I mean, that's great enough in its own right. Use the past tense there, and that's a great thing. I've been around that long. But he used the present tense. "Before Abraham was, I am." And I think that speaks not only to chronology, but to the matter of essence. His presence fills the universe. I am. You got one of those little papers you're filling out? That's why I put the big letters in there. I am. His presence fills the universe. He's speaking about his essence. And no one had ever spoken that way except Almighty God. And I think that's the issue, because this rings familiar in their ears. They have heard this before in the scriptures. For someone to speak of himself this way, "I am." Yet before Abraham was, "I am." It rang a familiar bell. The reason for that familiarity was that when in one of the most famous passages, in one of the most well-known passages of the Old Testament to them, it was about the time that they were going to get out of Egypt and be rescued, very familiar to them. Moses goes to the burning bush, a well-known passage to them. And he says to God, who's speaking to him, "When I go back to talk to them, they're going to ask me who sent me. And I'll say, 'The God of your fathers has sent me.' But they might say, 'What is his name?'" And God's response to that, I'm paraphrasing around, but here I'll quote Exodus 3:14. "This is what you're to say to the Israelites: I am has sent me to you." And that designation, that becomes the foundational reference to God in the scriptures of the Old Testament. It is a form of the Hebrew word to be. We know it as the word Yahweh. It's probably sort of an anglicized pronunciation. But Yahweh, it is a form of the Hebrew word to be. I am. That shows up in the Old Testament something close to 7,000 times with reference to God. I'm talking, this rings a bell. This is familiar. And for Jesus to speak similarly like that, "Before Abraham was, I am," would be very, very striking to them. If he had just said something as simple as, "I'm older than Abraham," they might have picked up stones to throw at him. I think there's something else at work here. I think they are saying, this is blasphemy of the greatest degree. He is using for himself the very designation that God used at the burning bush. I think that's what's going on here. Conclusion to all of this, there can be no neutral reaction to the one who says to you, "I am." Fundamentally, this is who's communicating with you. The one whose being is independent. I am.